morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another episode of Interop Radio. Brought to you by Interop Las Vegas, connecting the IT community. Interop Las Vegas comes to you April 27th through May 1st, 2015, at the lovely Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information and to register, please go to www.interop.com and be sure to use promo code RADIO for a $200 discount on your total access or conference passes. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to be doing two parts of our show once again, covering a full hour. We're going to begin with a conversation around technology of events. This will be led by one of our popular conference speakers, Romy Mahajan, with his guests, Ivan Tarapoff, CTO of Lemify, and John Huberman, Vice President for Business Development at Advaya. Our second half will be a conversation with Tim Titus, CTO of Path Solutions, one of the partner companies for the InteropNet and SDN Labs at Interop Las Vegas. We're going to be talking about problem and trouble tracking with Tim Titus. But before we get there, of course, we have this great conversation on event tech with Romy Mahajan. Romy, welcome to Interop Radio.
Thanks so much, Kurt.
And at this point, I think I'll turn your panel members over to you to begin the conversation.
Thanks again, Kurt. You know, I love Interop Radio, and I love being part of the broadcast every week. So today I have a really interesting topic and a really great bunch of people to speak on it. With Interop coming up, the inevitable question comes up for people as to what are they looking to get out of their investment in and time at the show. And one of the perennial themes is that people are looking, when they go to these shows, to meet with other people with whom they have affinity and with whom they can either conduct business or transact some sort of relationship. And in keeping with that, many different companies have invested quite a bit in the technology of networking for events. I've got two different perspectives on that, one from Ivan Tarapoff, who is the CTO of an interesting new company called Lemify, and I'll allow him to speak in a moment and describe his solution, and then John Huberman, the VP of Business Development for Advaya Solutions, a company dedicated to content development, digital marketing, with a very large connection to the event community. So let me start with restating the hypothesis and then get into the meat of the discussion. I've written before that people go to events for the three C's, for community, for content, and for commerce, in that order. And community really means the fourth C. It means connection, meaningful connection to other people with whom we have something in common and with whom we can do business. I'd like to run by the question, Ivan, do you believe in this hypothesis, Ivan? And if so, can you expound upon it a little bit?
Yes, thanks, Rami, and hello, everyone. Hello, all the listeners. So, we at Lemify, we truly believe in your hypothesis, and we believe that any events, any trade shows are they bring back the kind of the personal, the up close and personal relationship between people in the current loosely connected digital world. So we have all the social networks, we have the Facebook, we have the Twitter, so you can kind of connect to people with all those means. But when you are out there to do business, it's paramount that you actually see someone, be able to look them in the eye, to read their body language, to have a drink with them, or somehow connect with them. And this is what the trade shows are all about. But if you think about any trade show, there are just a lot of people there. If you think about a trade show like Interop, there's going to be, a dozen thousand people there or something like that. So if I'm there for 3 days, I can only meet probably, 50 or 40 people, right? And what are the chances that these people who I have the chance to talk to will actually be people who are interesting to me, who would help me to grow my business or to, you know, to sell the services of my company or accomplish whatever goal I pursue when I go to a conference like Interop? The chances are pretty slim, actually, and we have made this calculation, and this is what have led us to the idea of this, the Limify company. We're thinking of how to make this your trip to the event more useful, how to make your conversations at the event more meaningful, how to make sure that you're not not wasting your time talking to someone you don't actually want to talk, and you're not wasting someone else's time by having them talk to you while they would be rather looking for someone else. So we believe that the current technology is there that can, and the current technology can help increase this this process dramatically. So the advent of wearable technology, which has all these small powerful computers that can run for days on you, and that can talk to other devices like that, and that can transmit some vital information. So all that brings an interesting perspective here. And what we thought could help, could help solve this problem of meeting the right people, of building the community for the conference, of doing the proper commerce and getting the proper contact, is a small device which you could wear and which could tell you if there are interesting people nearby and who these people are. And this is essentially what our company is about, and this is what we do. So, Rami, I hope this was. I know that was quite a long answer, but I hope it answered your.
Excellent answer. So you believe in the hypothesis enough to say that you're actually building a company based on that hypothesis. Let me move to John Huberman. John, you not only invest quite a bit of time and money in going to events, but you also work with companies that host these events. Can you give us a bit of a sense of whether you believe this hypothesis and how you believe companies, whether they're or attendees, exhibitors, can get the highest ROI from their investment in these events?
I think that they can. I mean, it's trying to target the right type of people for those meetings, because as Tim said, you have a finite amount of time to meet with people while you're there. But there's a certain energy that is involved in a one-to-one meeting with people that you just aren't going to get in an email or in a web chat. And it's really trying to target and talk to the right people while you're there so that you can continue those conversations when you get back to your home office.
Okay. So given that, we both agree, or all three of us agree, that sort of networking and connecting with the right people to create a meaningful dialogue is one of the reasons that we go to events. But I would also argue that there are existing technologies at events that do allow you to connect. What's missing from what exists today, Ivan?
I believe that many of the current technologies are basically mobile apps and websites. So there are several categories, right? There are all kinds of mobile apps and websites that relay the conference schedule to you, that tell you where the talks are, where the booths are located, what are the schedule, and things like that. Then there is a separate category of apps that target the networking aspect of conference. And these apps, they try to establish some kind of community around the conference where you would be able to, to look up what people are there, send them some messaging or something like that. So these apps and websites, they lack this crucial piece that makes conferences valuable. They lack this personal communication. So you can send someone a message and tell them, okay, let's meet by, Samsung booth at 3:15 p.m. on Friday, right? But, what are the chances that the person will actually be there, and that it'll be convenient for you to be there? So conference, many meetings at the conference, a lot of networking at the conference, a lot of conversations with people at the conference are occasional, are random. So you meet someone in a line, or you meet someone while walking, or while viewing someone's booths, or while sitting next to them at the talk. So doing that or trying to meet someone, trying to factor in the social network here is really challenging. It does not really work. So personally, for me, I was never able to effectively use a conferencing app to meet someone. So I think what's missing is this kind of up close and personal networking piece. That's the...
John, does Ivan's experience mimic yours when you go to these events? I know you've told me before that you do end up meeting people, but maybe not always the right people. Is there something wrong or insufficient with the current tech solutions for networking at events?
Well, I just think that they're really broad. I mean, there's so many people in attendance that if you don't have a good plan of who you're trying to meet prior to going, it's really scattershot. You know, you could be sitting next to three people at a conference and not realize it, but wind up talking to two people that is really a salesman talking to salesman sort of situation. So you're not always sure that you're talking to people who what your point is relevant to their experience or their point is relevant to your experience. And so you just kind of move on. And as we said, you know, the events only last 3 to 5 days, so there is a finite amount of time. Right. So I would agree with Ivan that although we might know who's attending from a company standpoint, we don't always know the individuals, what their experience is. And, you know, it's a sales in general, but it's just escalated into a bit of a blender as there's so many attendees and so little time.
Very interesting. So it sounds like both of your experience actually point a little bit to what Ivan was saying earlier, that if there was a sort of a technology that that allowed you to create that that connection sort of in the moment when you're sitting next to someone and you'll be able to differentiate sort of a salesman talking to a salesman from maybe a salesman talking to a buyer, if you could somehow figure that out physically in that moment, it would be useful. Let me switch topics a tiny bit from that particular stream and talk about the culture of networking. Some people would argue that when you go to an event, networking is not about technology. It's about your attitude towards mingling and aggressively kind of going up to other people and finding out who they are. I posit that it's cultural, but that it can be helped or abetted by technology. Can you comment on that particular hypothesis, Ivan, that it's both cultural and technological?
Right, and that's a very good point, Romy. So, indeed, the thought that came a lot to each one of us at Plymify too, that events, they generate this, they kind of foster this specific culture where you need to be like proactive and basically, you know, interfere with people. This even a little bit sometimes gets into, you know, like this aggressive phase where where there is a person standing there and you have a hunch that, you know, this person might be the one who, I don't know if you're selling the service of your company, right? This might be someone who I would be willing to talk. He looks like a CEO, right? I want to talk to them. So you just approach them and you interrupt them and you start asking questions like, okay, so who you are, let's talk. So, you know, this culture does not resonate well with many people. So it would be, there are lots of people who are introverts by nature. I'm an introvert, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing that. So it would be really great if we could allow different communication scenarios, if we could do something to like change this culture to support different personality types. That's what I think for me. I don't know, does this sense for you?
Okay. I think that makes sense. I think that makes sense that if you're naturally aggressive, it might work. But for most people, they need a little boost, and that's where the technology comes in. John, how about you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that they're given some, like what Ivan's talking about, that would be an excellent in. It's just a precursor, sort of a minor introduction to the right people. Because it's really, if I come into contact with 150 people, I could say that it's going to be 125 cold calls. And we all know how enjoyable most of us find cold calling.
Yeah. Yep. Totally correct. So tell me a bit about, Ivan, can you walk me through the scenario? I mean, I don't want you to pitch the company. I would prefer you just to walk me through the scenario that you enable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the scenario would be like that. So think of a like as you enter the conference, right? So you have imagine that you had the means to tell some smart system, you know, some super mind like that's operating somewhere in the cloud, what are your interests? What kind of people you would like to meet? So you, if you're a salesman and selling services of your consulting company, you would say that I would want to meet the CEOs of companies who are interested in consulting, right? And you would program this, and you would somehow let your wearable device know that. So, so there would be a wearable device which you would be handed out with your conference badge. And as you walk the floor, imagine that there is a CEO of some company who is looking for consulting services like yours. So, some company who is looking for, I don't know, for someone who could help them out with the with building their next generation car stereo, for example. So they are just there to look for companies to do something like that who did a great job at that, right? So as you come close together, so the technology is there to notify you that there is someone who you might be interested in, and this person is actually interested in someone like you. So now, as you walk the floor, you would get notification, which would be like light or a gentle vibration that there is a person of interest nearby, and you would see actually a device on them lighting up too. So this is this would be a perfect icebreaker, you know. This would be something, some cue into a meaningful conversation that you could have. So this is the scenario that we imagine. I tried to stay away from pitching the company, but it feels like a pitch story.
No, I understand. But it's the scenario that's more important to me than the company itself. John, would you participate in that sort of scenario? Would you wear a some sort of wearable device that would light up when you were in the vicinity of someone with whom that you have affinity or with whom you think you need to connect from a business perspective?
I would definitely be willing to give it a shot. I mean, you know, just going back to the last question about the, you know, the aggressiveness where it's the loudest voice in the room, but not always the most intelligent voice in the room. I think that, you know, having some ability to connect me on a meaningful way to somebody who actually is interested in what I have to say would be incredibly powerful. So rather, just the knowing going in, and them knowing that from the other side that here's somebody who might have a solution to my pain.
Excellent. So I do have one other question, which is the internal skeptic in me is and this question is sort of raring to go, which is as we increase the number of technologies that that laid in our bodies or our downloads and our apps when we go to these events, what about all the data that's collected? Who uses it, and how is it all going to be consolidated so it actually gives me the best event experience I can and gives the organizer as much data as they need, but not too much, so they can put on better events going forward? Ivan, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so I think, so first, a solution like that, solution like we're developing, will definitely enable a lot of new data that has not been easily collected before, will enable relatively inexpensive, relatively, you know, low effort collection of that kind of this new data. Things like, you know, who people are, how people are interacting, what are the interesting topics, how much time people actually spend talking to each other, where people go, where they hang out most. So it's possible to enable location services based on this system that we're developing. You know, how many people have gone to this particular talk? How many people have left from this particular talk 5 minutes after the talk started? And you can make valuable conclusions based on that, right? So you can make decisions like whether I should invite this speaker or that speaker, whose speaker retention rate is bigger. So there's a lot of new data that's become available, and I completely see your point, Romeo, that this data could be overwhelming, especially once that each major event like Interop is probably using three or five or more event solutions that give them some data. So there is definitely a long road to go to consolidate all this data and make sense of the data so that event organizers can make valuable business decisions on that and optimize their bottom line, basically. So we recognize this problem, and we are talking to event organizers on how to how to make this data meaningful, and what sort of partnerships do we need to establish to, you know, to minimize the diversity of different systems that they have to interact with, the variety. You know? So,
excellent. John,
yeah,
John, what's your take on the different technologies and the different sort of collections of data and silos potentially of data that this could create, unless we do it right?
Well, I think it just, if it's not done correctly, there is currently a lot of noise. And, you know, as when you're in business development and sales, it's really filtering through that noise to find something that seems to work or that gives you direction. So I think with what, you know, Ivan's talking about, I don't know if that's going to add to the noise, because it's going to be more on the lines of being on the floor. So it's not adding to the before or after so much. It's really in the moment. But we do try to filter through the amount of noise, the variety of social platforms prior to and after to, and seeing what seemed to work given the approach that we and the tactical nature of how we looked at the events going in.
Are we really talking today around planned serendipity? Around the serendipity of running into somebody with whom you can do business or with whom you have an affinity, but doing it in a way that's slightly more planned than random. Ivan, are we talking about planned serendipity here at events?
Yeah, that's an interesting term, Romy, and I think that's very well reflects what we actually are trying to do. So, yeah, absolutely. This is how we envision the events of the future. You know, so there's a lot of serendipity, chance, randomness in meeting the right people at the events. And, you know, right now you're basically, you know, that these chances are all over and are close to you. You know, you might be sitting next to someone in a lunchroom and you're just silently eating your lunch. And when I do that, I always have this in the back of my head. Okay, so maybe this is the person who would like turn my company's life around, who can like bring in whatever major clients to me, or who can help me bring my product, promote my product. So a solution like that would allow you to plan for that, to prepare. It will not completely remove the role of chance from those encounters, from the success of those encounters, but definitely yes, planned chance, planned serendipity. This is a very good short description of what that is.
Excellent, John. You mentioned that as a business development person, it's all about your batting average, right? It's all about the number of conversations you have and how many of them are successful. Is this planned serendipity? Is that what we're looking at? Is that how we're going to increase your batting average?
I think so. I mean, I think that it's a much more eloquent way of putting it, but it's what we use on social media, some of the other platforms where we're looking to connect with somebody prior to a meeting or for a first contact or for an introduction. I mean, that's the goal there. This is just a little bit more immediate, but I think that's exactly what it is.
Excellent. So, you know, I'll end this with a couple editorial comments. I'm a big fan of physical events. I believe very much that they are the crucible in which community is formed, in which content is absorbed in ways that's very different than when you're doing it one-on-one, and in which commerce happens. I'm looking forward to Interop, and I'm also looking forward to the use of technology to increase and augment that event experience for the thousands of people who spend time, money, and wait, you know, for every, you know, once a year to go to this and other types of events. So with that, I look forward, Ivan, to seeing you at Interop. And hopefully your technology will help light up the world there. And John, I hope that Interop goes very well for you in your endeavor to sell the solutions and products that your company produces. With that, I'll hand it back to Kurt Franklin, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks a lot, Romy.
Romy, thank you, and thanks to all of our guests on this very interesting panel. It was led by Romy Mahan, CEO and President of KKM Group, Ivan Tellerpoff, CTO of Limify, and John Huberman, Vice President for Business Development for Advaya Solutions. Now, Romy will be part of the conference at Interop Las Vegas, and we look forward to listening to his panel and the panels of all of our conference speakers, there at Interop Las Vegas, connecting the IT community from April 27th through May 1st, 2015, at the beautiful Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas, Nevada. For more information and to register, please go to www.interop.com and be sure to use that radio promo code RADIO to get $200 off your total access or conference passes. Now, for the next part of Interop Radio today, we're going to be talking to Tim Titus. Tim Titus is CTO of Path Solutions, and I had a chance to spend quite a bit of time with Tim. He was there at Hot Stage in our warehouse at an undisclosed location in Silicon Valley. Tim, welcome to Interop Radio.
Thank you, Curtis.
Tim, you and I had a chance to talk about an awful lot of things, but one of the things that I know that you're very passionate about is troubleshooting. And, you know, it was interesting listening to the discussion in the first part of Interop Radio today. It seemed that they were talking about troubleshooting the entire conference experience. And when we talked about troubleshooting, I know that you were talking about it. Well, you know, obviously we're targeting it at the technology realm and the network realm, but a lot of what you were saying applies to general troubleshooting. What has made you spend so much time thinking about troubleshooting?
Well, connections that weren't made is a you know, social problem as well as a technology problem. That's a very interesting segue because if you fail to make a connection of somebody standing next to you, it's equivalent to, gee, I failed to make a connection on the network and get data transferred. You're transferring knowledge. It's a question as to, do you do that in person and did that work optimally in a social, physical environment, or did the data not get transferred in a network and network equipment model? Something, you know, a little bit about my background is I've been a network engineer for over 26 years now. Actually, I should probably change that to be about 27 years now. And one of the things that I've recognized is that troubleshooting these sort of connections in the networking world tends to be rather difficult in that most people don't have enough information to solve the problem. They end up looking at some, you know, one or two tools worth of information, and they come up with a conclusion that, gee, with those two tools worth of information, yeah, I could see how you'd come up with that conclusion, but you don't get the right conclusion because you're not looking at the right data. And I've just found that it's, I guess, the state of troubleshooting and the state of education regarding troubleshooting, my perception is that it tends to be rather poor, and in one sense, I think it tends to be rather poor because the people who are shouting at the top of their lungs saying, hey, use my tool to solve this problem, use this other tool to solve this problem. You have all of these marketing departments that are saying that their tool solves problems, and in one sense, I'd think, you know, there's a little bit of disclarity here. And I guess what I mean by disclarity is that some tools are perfect for confirming that you have a problem, but really not good at solving the problem. And I think if there was some market clarity that could have been created, that people would be able to look at things and say, okay, sometimes you do need to confirm a problem, because if this is that one user that always tends to complain about problems, half the time you're starting to wonder, gee, is the problem between the keyboard and the screen, or is the problem between the keyboard and the chair? I think we've heard that joke a few times.
Oh, absolutely.
The troubleshooting, you know, if you're looking to confirm a problem with a user, there's a certain type of tool that you want to use to confirm that, and that Many times that can be something that's going to confirm a user experience. I've seen APM types of tools, application performance monitoring types of tools, which will simulate a transaction. It will simulate a synthetic web fetch and say, gee, when you hit Yahoo's web page, it comes up in 50 milliseconds. That's a nice, quick web page fetch. But later in the day, that synthetic page fetch might end up taking 3 or 4 seconds, and you're thinking, wow, that's a huge difference. Anyone going out to that website is going to have 3 and 4 seconds to pull the page. That's not only lost productivity, but that might actually be people turning away from your website because it takes too long to actually pull up. So user experience testing is good for confirming that you have a problem, but it's not going to help find the problem. Another example I've seen is when you have, let's say, a sniffer. People think they can solve all sorts of problems with sniffers, and I will say, for certain types of problems, it is the solution. The problem is, it's not a panacea to solve all of the problems. For example, if you had a VoIP call quality problem where you say, gee, the person on the other end of the phone call has a choppy connection, people pull a sniffer out and think, hey, I can solve this with this sniffer. Well, if you think about what the results are, and this is really what I'd like to encourage folks to consider, is that when you think about what are the results you achieve from the solution, and if you can frame those results and say, what does this actually give me? And a sniffer is going to look at the packets that the sniffer sees passing on the wire that you're looking at. Well, a VoIP phone call that's poor is going to be missing a bunch of these packets because they were lost somewhere. They were either thrown away due to a bad cable or due to bandwidth limitations upstream or some sort of problem upstream. So what you're going to see is say, gee, we should have had 100 packets. We only saw 70 packets. That means 30 packets went missing somewhere. That's 30% packet loss. Well, you have confirmation that you have a problem. It's not going to tell you where those packets went missing or why. You just have confirmation. So I guess this is my experience, is that many times people will pull up their favorite tool to say, hey, let's go solve this problem with my favorite tool that I just pulled out of my pocket here. And you need to consider what the results are from that tool. Just because that hammer worked perfectly on that last job doesn't mean it's going to really help you for that next job. So it's choosing the right tool, depending upon what you're looking to do, is really the most critical task, because a salesman's going to try and sell you their tool no matter what. But if you think about, this tool gives us confirmation, maybe that's what you're looking for, confirmation that there is a problem that ought to be resolved, then that's the type of tool you want to pull out of your toolkit. But if you're looking beyond confirmation and say, gee, we've tried 6 different tools, and every one of these tools ends up confirming that we have a problem, but we're no closer to getting it resolved, then maybe you need to stop and think about is, what type of tool are you using, and what are the results that that tool should be showing you to help you resolve that problem?
Okay, now I want to poke a little bit at what you've been saying, because I think it would be possible to listen to your conversation and say that troubleshooting successfully is all about just filling your technology quiver with enough troubleshooting tools, that if you're not getting the right information, well, obviously you just need another tool. And so if I buy enough of these different tools, well, sooner or later I'm going to cover the waterfront, I'm going to have every kind of data I could possibly need, and my troubleshooting worries will be over. Is that really where you're going with this?
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. I think we've encountered situations where we all have worked for organizations where you look and say, gee, there's tool overload here, where you have 17 different tools that you can choose to use to solve problems. And there might be some overlap from some tools to the other, and you start thinking, geez, I don't know where to start. Which tool do I pull out? I think in general, what needs to be considered is that you need to look at the network from different perspectives, and whether that those different perspectives means that you end up saying, gee, I can survive and get enough information by having four tools in my toolkit, or maybe your environment's a little bit different, or the way you work is a little bit different, and you say, you know, I really need eight tools to be able to see what's going on. Because sometimes, just like if you draw a perfect parallel to your mechanic, you go in and look at the tools that your mechanic has, and they're going to sit there and say, yeah, they've got a number of different tools, but they might also have that one rare socket that gets used when they have a 1972 Pinto come in for service. They figure, you know, there's enough market that they have that tool that they need that. Then there's going to be mechanics that say, you know what, we're not going to ever encounter a 1972 Pinto. We don't need that type of tool. So they can survive saying, gee, we only service American cars. We don't need a metric tool set. Or they might say, gee, we service American and European cars. We need a metric and a standard tool set. So the tool sets are really dependent upon the environment and the users using the tools. Having a lot of tools can get very confusing. You can end up having data overload. On the other hand, if you know what each tool can produce as a result, and you have a very clear picture of here is the result from that, then you can actually have some really accurate diagnosis. If you think about a doctor, you go into a doctor and say, gee, I'm not feeling well. And that doctor says, oh, okay, I have five tests I can put you through to actually try and determine what's going on. And they say, I'm going to have your blood work done. I'm going to have a CBC, a Chem7, these various different blood work tests done. Okay, if those tests come back and say, hey, you've got the flu, then great, it worked. But if those tests come back and say, nope, everything's perfectly fine, there's no problems, then that doctor doesn't have enough tools in their tool set. They probably need 12 different tests so that they can test and say, oh, actually, yeah, you have liver disease. The other doctor didn't test for that because they didn't have it in their tool belt. But they can, and they can say, here's exactly what you have going on. So you want to protect against information overload by having too many tools. Also, the cost of support for a lot of those tools can be significantly higher, but you want enough information where you don't end up having like four tools that confirm situations and no tools to resolve situations. So it's that you want to have some tools to help confirm, some tools to help resolve, some tools to be able to measure performance across the network and say, gee, are users getting a good experience? Typically, those experience types of tools are used more by management-level folks to say, I want to make sure that we're giving those users a good experience because my bonus is tied to it. So they end up getting management-level performance monitoring solutions that focus on making sure that that's achieved. But what many times gets missed is that, okay, performance is now terrible. How fast can your team actually find the problem and resolve it? And if you don't have the right tool to cover that base, all of that performance monitoring is going to mean nothing because it might be weeks or even months to be able to get to the root cause of that performance problem, and there goes your bonus, and perhaps there goes your job.
Okay, now it's interesting to me because you talk about the management level tools. I know that one of the trends in all kinds of tools is the addition of intelligence to the tool, so that the tool is not just reporting. There are, in many cases, also prescriptive elements to the tool. So why isn't it yet the case, I mean, if you've got all of these wonderful tools, that you can't just run your suite of tools first thing in the morning while you're getting your first cup of coffee, come to your console, and have something that says, you know, there's a copper interface over here on port 37 on switch 92 that is getting ready to go bad. You really should replace that switch today. Or, you know, something happened and there's an issue with line 647 in the config file for this particular switch, and you should change this parameter. I mean, do you still really need the expertise in the network engineer, or are we yet to the point where the software, if you choose the right tools, will the software take care of that expertise for you?
So, excellent question. And if you think about where the industry has come from and where the industry is going to over the past even 5 years, is that it used to be you'd have tools that would provide you with raw data about what was going on, and you still needed to have that expert on staff looking around to say, here's how to interpret that data. Really, the point that you're making is very valid, is that a lot of solutions are moving in that direction, and they're moving pretty quickly in that direction, specifically to allow for the senior-level person to troubleshoot faster, because it points out, you know, conclusions that are able to be drawn, because it's no longer data. It's now actionable information, and that's really the difference between the word data and the word information, is data is just numbers. Information actually makes sense of those numbers by putting intelligence against it. So having a solution that automatically analyzes these sort of conditions and says, hey, here's what's broken, that's really very new in the market right now. That's something that that our company is providing as a solution, root cause troubleshooting, plain English answers. But that's really where the market tends to be moving, and companies that don't seem to have this sort of automatic analysis means that they're going to be stuck kind of back in the mode where they're doing analysis of data, wondering, gee, I have this over here and that over there, and what does this all mean together? They're going to have to either hire on some very seasoned level network engineers to do the analysis, or pay an outside company to come in and do that sort of analysis to help them with that troubleshooting, and that tends to get really expensive. If you think about where we're going, is I'll describe an example that I've seen, is that it used to be when you took your car into the mechanic, is that you'd have the master mechanic go through that car top to bottom to try and find out, why is the engine running rough? And they might spend 30 minutes poking at things, messing with things, checking things, and that master mechanic would then come up and say, aha, eureka, spark plug number 4 is bad. We need to replace that, and that'll fix the problem. Well, having that master mechanic on staff is expensive, and having them spend 30 minutes to try and do a diagnostic is also expensive, and a lot of people sit there and complain saying, well, I don't want to pay for you to diagnose it. So it ended up creating a lot of contention in that industry. Well, to solve that problem, what a lot of the car companies do these days is they have this little plug down under the dash. What will happen is you bring your car into the dealership and say, the engine's running rough. What's causing this? Well, they get a high school kid to come out with this box. They plug the box in under the dash. They press the big red button, and it prints out a little script that says, spark plug number 4 is bad. Replace it. Now, the magic here is that box, because it's done that automation and the diagnostic and put together all of the intelligence about what's broken, so that you can now go in and say, oh, I don't have to pay the $70 analysis fee to the mechanic. I can effectively say, great, what does it cost to have that spark plug replaced? And you end up having the high school kid put the spark plug in, and you're on your way within 10 minutes. So not only are the problems solved faster, they're solved less expensively, and they're solved more to everybody's satisfaction. So I see the exact same thing happening in the world of networking, is that if you're still working under the days of old saying, gee, we're analyzing SNMP data manually, we're analyzing records and information manually, and saying, gee, we have to have a ton of experts on call and have them in all the time to analyze what's going on in this network, that's going to cost you a fortune. And I just think that those days are rapidly coming to a close, is that there needs to be a high amount of not only automation, but intelligence analysis, like done in that little box that plugs up under the dash, so that you can have folks in the telecom area be able to find and resolve call quality problems in the networking arena, so that, honestly, that both the networking and telecom team can work collaboratively together on solving these sort of weird problems that happen and then mysteriously disappear. So I think there's a massive change going to be happening as troubleshooting becomes more optimized.
You're talking about that massive change, and as you're sitting there describing situation, I fully understand, because I've you know, you can go to Amazon now, and for under $100, you can get an ODB2 analysis tool that you stick into that port and see what's going on. I'm wondering how long it's going to be before you have old school network admins who go into the executive's office clad in the priestly robes of ill-fitting short sleeve shirt and pocket protector to chant jargon describing how difficult the problem will be to find and solve. And the executive just looks at his smartphone and says, well, according to this, it's port 47 over on switch number 18. Why don't you just change the switch? You know, the first time that happens, it's a major culture shift.
Yeah, it is a bit of a culture shift, but I think what tends to happen is, and this is something I've seen happen in a number of different cases, is if you have smart managers, the smart managers will do is they'll recognize that rather than having to have their senior level person work on trouble tickets and troubleshooting these sorts of problems, they say, we're going to keep you on staff and focused on strategic level initiatives. We have whole network build outs that need to be done. We have major reconfigurations that need to be done. Troubleshooting these sort of problems is something we can now push down to the help desk level or the telecom level and say, they can solve the problems on their own. They don't need you for that. And what now happens is you have the help desk working on network and telecom tickets that normally they wouldn't have the skills to do so. But if they have the tools to do so, they can now achieve that. And you now have the networking team working on strategic level initiatives, which effectively match better with their typically higher salaries. And everybody's getting more out of the entire staff, and the efficiency goes up dramatically. I think that's really what I'm seeing happen in a lot of organizations. And it's not that these senior level grizzled, you know, phone guys and telecom guys and network guys, and I'll freely put myself in that same bin. It's that the efficiency has to improve. Otherwise, if you're left doing things the old way, you're just going to be a typewriter repairman. there's not much left there in the market for that type of work.
Well, I think one of the questions that I'd love to get into with you, and it may be that, well, you have talked about the fact that there need to be some articles over at Information Week about this, and I'm looking forward to working with them, with you on those articles. But with all of the tools that are now available and the new analytics that are part of those tools, there's still the need for a solid troubleshooting methodology in place. And you can't just walk in, start madly punching buttons, and expect great results. Do you find when you talk to different engineers that there are still some deficiencies in the general troubleshooting methods that are in use?
Yeah, methodology is something that I'm a huge fan of methodology, and there's been, I fear, a lack of training of good methodology for folks when they go to try and solve problems. I think we've all heard and dealt with a poor methodology in the market, figuring that somebody comes up and says, well, just reboot the router. And it's like, well, wait a minute, hold on. Rebooting something doesn't mean the problem is going to be fixed, and even if it is fixed by rebooting it, you've lost all telltale signs of what actually caused the problem, which means it's only going to happen again. So bad methodology is something that I fear you see it all the time. People say, oh, change something, change this, change that, make changes, start fixing it. And it's that they make conclusive jumps without enough information. If you walked into the doctor and the doctor looked and said, you know, I think we want to do a heart transplant. Worked on my last patient. Maybe it'll work here. I don't think you'd feel too comfortable about that sort of decisive reasoning, and you'd say, why don't we do some more tests? Why don't we collect more information about what's going on? And once they collect more information and they find out, oh, gee, well, what's your chief complaint? Your chief complaint is heartburn. they're going to hand you some Tums or hand you an antacid to fix your problem and say, well, maybe they shouldn't try the heart transplant as the first thing to try. So, you know, one of the things with troubleshooting is people tend to not collect enough information, and they jump to a conclusion that if you collected more information about what was actually going on and put this information together logically, you know, I've seen people, they try and work it out in their head, and I really found, I'm a huge fan of whiteboards. If you can document, when does this problem happen? And this is going back to the tool selection. If you have confirmation of when the problem happens via a tool versus a user, because the user will say, gee, it seems to happen a couple times per day, maybe noon, maybe 1 o'clock, maybe 3 o'clock, and that's kind of maybes. But if you actually had a tool that confirmed, gee, it seems to be at 12:05 every day, you know, that there's this glitch on the network that happens. Well, you now have a tool that confirms that there's a problem, and you have more accurate information about the fact that it's at 12:05. If you then collected information from all of those switches and routers and found out that, gee, every one of these switches and routers has a CPU spike at that exact same time. Okay, then let's collect some more information as to what might be causing this CPU spike. You end up collecting log files from these devices, and you determine that, gee, the log files say that every one of these routers and switches is being backed up to a TFTP server at that time. Okay, you now know what's causing the CPU spike. They're building their config files and saving it. Well, you then go back and find out that your automated network equipment backup strategy has it do a backup on all these devices at that exact same time. And you think, oh, maybe this should have been 12:05 p.m. every day and not a.m. You've just found the root cause. And it's because you have enough information of all of this that you can get that conclusion reached. Whereas previously, people don't have enough information, and they just say, well, let's reboot some routers and switches and see if the problem goes away. So it really comes down to the continue to collect information before making any changes so that you're not blinding yourself and making assumptions that lead you down a bad path.
Well, now, pardon me, we've been talking about troubleshooting and information, and as we're getting down towards the end of our time here on this episode, I do want to wrap back, because providing that information is a big piece of what you and Path Solutions are doing as part of the InteropNet, isn't it?
Correct. So what we do is we are doing a collection of information in an automated fashion about the entire network. In one sense, the NOC team is responsible for that entire infrastructure, and what our software will do is install and tell you, here's what is going on all of these switches, all of these routers, all of these interfaces, pull all of that data back, and then put our heuristics engine against it to analyze it and say, okay, here's what's broken. That way, within just a few minutes, we can go up to the right team and say, hey, you've got a jumbo frame misconfiguration on this port over here. Go up to the cabling team and say, hey, this cabling doesn't look good because the switch is dropping a whole bunch of packets and effectively telling us that there's a cabling fault here. We found a memory leak on a router that was misconfigured, and they changed the OS on that router, and that problem went away. So it's being able to rapidly find these problems, which leads me to another future discussion that we can have is about pre-diagnostics and pre-troubleshooting. Is if you know what was broken, you could fix it before the users complain. And so that's really part of our ability to say, let's get that information. Let's get more information than with any other solution. Let's analyze it and give it to you in a plain English format so that it's easy to understand what's broken and get the problem resolved.
Well, that certainly sounds like an important set of things to do, an important set of capabilities, and an important group of discussions I'm looking forward to having with you in the future. Now, one of the things I've been asking the people who are representing companies that are part of InteropNet and the SDN Lab is whether you're doing any education, any whiteboard sessions, any sessions in your booth, any kind of education at Interop. Is that something that's going to be going on with Path Solutions?
Yeah. Actually, at Interop, we actually have two different sessions. So we have a NOC theater session, 2:00 in the NOC theater, and it's going through root cause troubleshooting the Interop net. And then we also have a root cause troubleshooting session at 3:00 in the vendor tech session I room. That's the big conference room right outside of the expo hall. And we're going to go through root cause troubleshooting, what types of information you need to collect, what are some good practices for getting problems troubleshot, and then a little bit about our product.
Well, we are looking forward to hearing those. We definitely suggest that anybody coming to Interop make sure to attend your sessions, because there's a lot of great information there. And Tim, I'm certainly looking forward to talking with you at Interop and having you as a guest on future episodes of Interop Radio.
Great. Thank you, Curtis. Appreciate the time.
Well, I want to thank my guest today, starting with Tim Titus, CTO of Solutions, who has been my guest here on the second half of this episode of Interop Radio. I also want to go back and thank my guests on the first half of the show. Mahajan, CEO and President of Kaken Group, Ivan Terapov, CTO of LifeFi, and John Huber, VP Business Development for Advaya Solutions. All of these gentlemen have brought us a lot of great information. We appreciate them taking the time to be with us. Now, great information is really a big what goes on at Interop Las Vegas, connecting the IT community, which will happen May 27th through May 1st, 2018, at the beautiful Mandalay Bay Convention Center in Las Vegas. For more information and register, please go to www.interop.com and be sure, when you register, to use the promo code RADIO, because those five little letters will save you $200 on your full conference registration. We're getting very close to Interop 2015. We've got two more episodes of Interop Radio before we get to Las Vegas. Once we're in Las Vegas, we have a ton of shows coming your way. We're going to have at least a dozen live shows from Interop Las Vegas. There will be some posts on the Interop tab of informationweek.com that talk about the schedule, talk about what we're going to be doing. Please look us up there and plan to be with us. If you're listening to this in podcast form, well, that means you've already found it. If you're listening to this streaming on Blog Talk Radio, you can find us in podcast form on iTunes. And if you're doing either one of those things, we want to remind you that Interop Radio comes your way live every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern. We would love to have you here for our live presentation. Well, for all of our guests and everyone here at Interop Radio, this is Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next week.